occasion. Right, okay. I'd like to introduce to you a very interesting curiosity, which is this book. There is a more modern edition, which is fatter, but this is a book of philosophy by a Hasidic leader, the Tzemach Tzedek, living in the middle of the 19th century. Now, why this should be a curiosity, I will try to explain in terms not of the Tzemach Tzedek or the Chabad Hasidic leaders, but we're going to turn for a moment to Rabbi Nachman of Breslov, a great Hasidic leader in the third generation of Hasidism. He passed away in 1810. He strenuously forbade his followers from reading Jewish philosophy. He said they should not even look at or inside the book Guide for the Perplexed, and he could tell on their face if they ever had done so. However, Rabbi Nachman reserved for himself the right or the duty to himself study the Guide for the Perplexed and other works of Jewish philosophy, which his followers transmitted was in order to rescue the souls of those who had fallen into the clutches of rationalist thinking. Now, Joseph Weiss interpreted this aspect of Rabbi Nachman of Breslov as his own particular psychological issue. Arthur Green explores in a more, this is what existential, you know, this is the existential issue of life, of being. It takes it in a wider way. I would like to suggest that for most Hasidim, Rabbi Nachman's view had some relevance. Then, when we come to the Chabad school, we have something which is very interesting, very intriguing. In fact, the Rabbi Sholom Dover, the fifth Lubavitcher Rebbe, claimed that all the disciples of the Maggid of Mezritch, in other words, all the third generation Hasidim, except for Rabbi Nachman, who was not a disciple of the Maggid of Mezritch, they all studied the Guide for the Perplexed. And there is some literary evidence to support that view, because we find an individual like Rabbi Avraham of Kalisch actually quoting the guide, but not by name. But he writes down ideas that are definitely from the Guide for the Perplexed. However, for the generality of Hasidim, the idea of the Guide for the Perplexed, as indeed not only for Hasidim, but for other thinkers, there's the rationalist mystical divide. And it's assumed that the Hasidim are in the world of the mystics and the rationalism is in some other section of the bookshelf. It's some other part of the library. Now, the intriguing thing about this book is that it combines both. And the way it combines both, we can see right away in the title page. The title page says, Sefer HaChakira. Chakira is an old word for philosophy. Today it means investigation, research, but it's Book of Philosophy, which is also called Derech Emunah, the Path of Faith. Philosophy first, faith second. However, we turn over the page, it's got it the other way round. Derech Emunah, path of faith, which is also called Hachakira, philosophy. So right on the title page, you've got the ambiguity about this book. Now, let me try to present a little bit about what is in this book. How much time do I have?
Half an hour.
Okay. Now, Now, in some of the manuscripts, the first way in which we see this book is as a sort of a set of manuscripts among the thousands of pages of manuscripts that were left, the Nachlas of the Tzemach Tzedek. Because I don't think he managed to publish anything of his own during his own lifetime, because there were severe government laws against the publishing of anything except a very limited range of Hebrew books. However, shortly after he passed away, the volumes of his responsa and his Talmudic thought were published, but it took many years before any other writings of his, not until the second decade of the 20th century was the beginning of other writings. Now, his writings fill, I'm not sure if you have all of them here, but it's about 40 volumes of printed writings. But all of those were left as manuscripts. So this book of philosophy and faith, start off, we see them as a bunch of manuscripts. They were first published first printed in 1912, and then again in 1957 by the 7th Lubavitcher Rebbe. So the fact of the way they were published is also part of the interesting thing about them, which I hope I'll have time to mention. Now, the work has, in some of the manuscripts, this work has an introduction, a discussion by the Tzemach Tzedek of Isaiah's words, "Su'u meroim einechem, lift your eyes to the heights, ura'u mi bara ele, and see who created these." He is discussing, the theme of the book is the divine origin of the universe, and the idea that God created the universe. Now, the idea that God creates the universe and the idea that God is essential to the universe are two different concepts. In the Aristotelian view, God is essential to the universe, but the concept of creation is not part of Aristotelian thought. For Aristotle, God and the universe are both eternal. The universe depends on God. God is the prime mover, but there is no concept of creation in Aristotle's thought. What the Tzemach Tzedek is trying to do is to prove the concept of creation. That's the main theme of the book. He uses philosophical works to express that idea, and some of his own ideas as well, which we will encounter. So now this idea, lift up your eyes to the heights and see who created the stars. This concept is the idea that if you look at the stars, you can, that is evidence for the divine creation of the universe, that you lift up your eyes to the heavens. I mean, in terms of the argument from design, for example, the universe so beautifully designed and the stars in the sky. Now, he then quotes Maimonides' Guide for the Perplexed, part 2, chapter 19. And he is using that text, that philosophical text, in order to prove the concept, to demonstrate the concept of God from the stars in the sky. Now, this part 2, chapter 19, is an extremely interesting passage in Maimonides, in the guide. We have the problem that Maimonides says that he's not going to say exactly what he means at every point. We have a further problem that Leo Strauss introduced even further levels of ambiguity and esotericism in his reading of Maimonides. Now, obviously, or not obviously, but the Tzemach Tzedek did not subscribe to Strauss's view, but he also he is aware, and he speaks about the idea of Maimonides speaking in one mode when in fact he means something else, and we'll see how this comes out. Now, what Maimonides says in part 2, chapter 19 of the guide, is that if you say that the world, that the universe and God are both eternal, and that therefore the existence of the universe is a necessity from the divine, not that the divine suddenly decided he's going to create the world at a certain point, but that it's always been there and it has to be there, then you have a question. Why should this group of stars be like this and the other group of stars be like that? If it's all that it's of necessity that the universe exists because God exists, and God has no choice, so then you have a question about everything in existence. Why is it just like that? If you say God has a choice, then you have a simple answer. God, in his wisdom, made it in this way or in that way. So the particularism of the universe is what is the focus of Maimonides' thought in this chapter, 2:19. And so the fact that the universe is in this particular way, particularly he speaks of the stars and other things as well, that is that helps you understand how meaningful it is that God chose to create the world at a particular time, the universe creating a particular time. Now, so the Tzemach Tzedek moves. This is in the Tzemach Tzedek's introduction to this book, from some of the manuscripts and what becomes the introduction in the printed work. So he then makes an interesting step that he maps. Using this sort of philosophical lever, in order to prove the existence of God, not only God as creator, he then maps the Talmud and Kabbalah together in an interesting way, because in the Talmud it talks about different firmaments. The idea that there are seven firmaments, right? The Bible begins, God says, Yehi Rakia, let there be a firmament. Now, what exactly is a firmament? The Talmud says there are in fact seven firmaments. Now, it's interesting that the Kabbalists say that there are seven sfirot, seven divine emanations. So the Tzemach Tzedek links those together, and also links those together with the concept of spheres, the Greek concept of spheres. So we've got a sort of a continuum where we have biblical and Talmudic firmaments, Greek spheres, and Kabbalistic spherot. Even the terminologies. And they all form, for the Tzemach Tzedek, it all forms a continuum. And in fact, that's the thrust of this book. It is all a continuum. Whichever way you look at the world, whether you look at the world philosophically, or you look at it Kabbalistically, or you look at it Talmudically, it's all one. It's all one. It all comes from God. And it may seem that you get to an edge in one of these areas where you don't see the other, dimensions, but in fact they are all integrated, and if you would only look at it all in a subtle enough way, then you will see the unity. Now, he also cites the guide, and also Albo quotes this in the Ikarim, the idea that God is the necessary existence, the mechuyav hametziyut, the necessary existence which is the basis of all the contingent existence, which is is the rest of existence. Now that is a fascinating concept. This concept is saying that if anything exists, it's because God is making it exist. God is the essential fulcrum in everything. And he says right at the beginning, Maimonides says at the beginning of his Mishneh Torah, you could imagine, if you would imagine, that there's no God, then nothing else would exist. Whereas, if you would imagine that there's no universe, then there would just be God. Right? He's flipped Spinoza off the board. and he has made this very profound point that the universe is totally dependent on God. And in fact, in the guide, as we have in... we'll come to this in a second, hopefully. Now, so what he discusses... In this book, he discusses sadhya, beliefs and opinions, emunot v'deyot, bachya, duties of the heart, which has got a rationalist opening section, the guide and its traditional commentaries, and some later commentaries as well, philosophical passages in Maimonides' Laws of the Foundations of Torah, Albo's Ikarim, and a scientific work, Nechmad v'Naim, by David Gantz, who was a scholar who knew Tycho Brahe. In this work, he's bringing all these sources together, particularly in order to prove, to demonstrate the concept of God, the belief in God, and the idea of creation. Now, let's take something in the first chapter. Sadhya demonstrates the world is finite. The world is finite. Now, if the world is finite, one way of demonstrating that the world is finite, philosophically, is to say, this book is finite. You can measure the book from here to there. The book is a little bit of the world. If a little bit of it is finite, then the whole universe must be finite. Yeah. Right? Because a little bit of infinity would be infinite. So if you we learn in math, if there are infinite number of points in a line, and you cut off a little bit of line, 1 inch long, well, there's an infinite number of points in it. So therefore, if you're talking about infinity, any little bit of infinity is still infinite. But we can measure this book, and it's finite, and so there, and the book's part of the universe, so the universe is finite. If it's finite in space, must be finite in time. If it's finite in time, it's got a beginning and an end. So therefore, the universe has a beginning, and God created it. So that's one route. And in fact, the Talmud agrees that the world is finite, because the Talmud speaks about the way that the firmaments, come back to the firmaments, the distance between each firmament is a distance of 500 years. It's interesting, they count in years. We talk in light years. But they speak about years. But even if it's 500 years, it seems a long way, but it's still finite. It's still limited. So therefore, now, this is what he focuses on. Since we therefore have a finite universe, and there's this concept of everything rotating, right? The ninth sphere, and making all the other spheres rotate. So we have a finite structure which is rotating. Now, if we assume that it's rotating all the time, what is making it rotate? Because if it is God, if it's finite, you cannot have an infinite force within a finite structure. It must be an infinite force which is outside it, and that infinite force is God. So therefore, the finitude of the universe becomes a way to prove the idea of God as the infinite force outside it. And in order to quote this, in order to explain this, he quotes Maimonides' statement actually in Laws of the Foundation of the Torah, not in his guide, but in his more general work, Mishneh Torah, that this existence of who is making the outer sphere move is God, the master of the whole world. He is the one who moves the sphere, quoting from Maimonides here, with infinite and unbounded power. This force has no interruption because the sphere rotates continuously, and it's impossible that it should move without a mover. It is He, God, may He be blessed, who moves it without a hand and without a body. Now, there's something Maimonides did not mention in this passage, that it's God who created the whole thing. He says simply that God is making it move. God is the prime mover, making it move all the time. He hasn't actually said that God created it. The Tzemach Tzedek is surprisingly relaxed about that point. He is aware, he's fully aware of it. He cites Sadia's first proof for the creation of the universe. You see, Sadia uses a very similar way of thinking about the universe in order to prove that God created the universe. The universe is there rotating and it's finite, so there, how can it exist? It must be brought into being by an infinite being, which is God. Why is it that Maimonides doesn't speak about creation? The Tzemach Tzedek comments, Maimonides proves from this only that there is a God of the universe, a master of the whole world, but he does not prove from this that the universe is created. This is because he's following the words of Aristotle, who thinks that God, may he be blessed, moves the sphere eternally, which means the sphere exists and moves in this way forever. In other words, the Tzemach Tzedek is saying that Maimonides has entered into the Aristotelian worldview. Now, does the Tzemach Tzedek think that Maimonides accepted that? No. He comes back to Maimonides' proof and he says, in fact, this proof can also help one believe in creation. However, for it is surely easier to believe in creation when it's been explained without reference to creation that you must have God. In other words, the Tzemach Tzedek is giving a rationale that Maimonides himself claims. First of all, prove the existence of God. There may be a whole lot of people who believe the universe is eternal together with God. So, or they don't believe in God, but they think the universe is eternal. Okay, prove to them that God exists. Now that you've proved that God exists, it's a relatively easy task to prove that God created the world. That's the way Maimonides himself states the position at various points, including a manuscript addition to his text of the 13 Principles of Faith. In the fourth principle, in his own handwriting, which might be here in Oxford, I think it is. There is a manuscript here in the Bodleian in Maimonides' handwriting, but there may be more than one. There's a manuscript that Kappach uses. You know, it's the basis here. Anyway, he adds a note. to his expression of the fourth principle of the four, of the 13 principles of faith, an essential idea is the idea of creation. He writes like this. The fourth principle is eternity, that this one who has been described as the absolute eternal, and all that exists apart from him is not eternal in relation to him. And this fourth principle is indicated in the verse, Ma'oin Elohim. Now, then he adds, and know that the great fundament, this is his addition, his footnote, added years later, know that the great fundament of the Torah of Moses, our teacher, is that the world is created. God formed it and created it after complete nothingness. The fact that you see that I circle around the idea of the eternity of the world, Sha'ani sovev saviv inyan kadmut ha'olam, according to the opinion of the philosophers, is in order that there should be definite proof of God's existence, as I have indicated in the guide. Now, so that means the guide was written many years after his commentary on the Mishnah, and he's come back to it after having written the guide, and he comes back and writes this little addition. Someone suggests, Davidson suggests, that after he had written the guide for the perplexed, he saw more clearly that you have to put the belief in creation as an actual focus, as one of the 13 principles of faith. Now, the Tzemach Tzedek, of course, didn't see this handwritten note, but he understands the direction of Maimonides, that what he's trying to do is prove the existence of God, and then prove that God created the world as two separate issues. And the Tzemach Tzedek discusses attacks on the Rambam, on this score. For example, Rabbi Joseph Albo in Yekarim quotes, mentions this idea which was there at the beginning of Laws of the Foundation of the Torah, and he declares, Albo declares, since this proof is built on the idea of constant eternal motion, as the philosopher, i.e. Aristotle, assumes, in other words, the eternity of the universe, and this is something which no member of our divine religion believing in creation can accept, I'm not even going to discuss it. So Albo throws it off the table. I'm not going to talk about this little bit of Maimonides. The Tzemach Tzedek defends Maimonides against Albo. He says, no, on the contrary, Maimonides is simply trying to help people first by proving the existence of God and then coming later to the question of creation. Let's see another example of the Tzemach Tzedek using a kind of philosophical approach. He discusses a discourse by his grandfather, the Rabbi Shneur Zalman, which claims that the existence... One second. The problem is lack of time. So what I would like to... He gives a number of different discussions where he shows that you can assume the negative that you do not believe in order to then prove A, and then you come back to question B. So, for example, there's a discussion about proving the existence of God from the microcosm to the macrocosm. What's the microcosm? The human person. So the human person has within them a soul. And the soul is like God within the universe. But what about the question whether or not the soul is eternal? So if you are assuming that the soul is eternal, and so therefore the soul in the body is like eternal God in the universe, So you're arguing from your own premise. You're trying to pull yourself up by your own bootlaces. The phrase he uses, avoch avo tzorich, your proof needs a proof. So he says, you know what? Which is actually a Talmudic phrase, and it's also in the Guide for the Perplexed. So he says, you know what? Let's say the soul is not eternal. Now, obviously, he doesn't believe that. But he says, let's say, for argument's sake, that the soul is not eternal. But still, you have the soul in the body, and the soul is the life of the body. So that's the microcosm. In the same way, we have a macrocosm, God and the universe. Now, when we're talking about God and the universe, God is eternal. So it's like he's breaking up conceptual steps so that you can start off with a position, a kind of a secularized, a rationalized position, where the soul is not eternal. But giving that picture of the microcosm with the soul within the body, the life of the body, then you come to the life of the universe, the divine. Then we can come back and say, well, actually, God is eternal. God is, and not only is God eternal, the soul is also eternal. He'll come back to that. So the same way, in a sort of parallel way to working with the question of creation, you can start by assuming the point that you do not believe, proving something else, and then coming back and proving another issue. All right, so there are fascinating discussions in this book on that, and then it concludes with an interesting statement. Now, here has been there's also his own proofs for the creation of the world, which are quite outside they're not the ordinary philosophical position. He says, if the world has always existed, how come there are not more people? We all know that population is expanding, he says, which is a point that was realized quite a few hundred years earlier, that population is expanding. So if it had been expanding all this time, and you're saying that the world's existed for millions and millions and millions of years, how come the population hasn't covered the entire planet? That's one point. And then he says, and what about inventions? Recently there have been invented printing press, the Zega, like clocks, other inventions, and they discovered America. Why weren't all these discoveries and inventions made earlier on, if the whole thing's been going for millions of years? So long ago, people should have invented all these things. So all this is his extra proofs for the creation of the world. Now then he writes at the end, now here has been explained, even according to my small understanding, 10 proofs for the creation of the world. Those are his own proofs. And in addition, all these philosophical proofs. Nonetheless, the main thing is simple faith. Here we are, book of philosophy, book of faith. The main thing is simple faith, which is far better, as it's stated in the Kuzari at the beginning of the fifth discourse. Only for someone whose heart is not sure, it's better to examine the above-mentioned proofs rather than remain uncertain. This, too, is written there in the Kuzari. How do you strengthen faith? Through studying Torah, because Torah is called truth and is the source of faith, as in the phrase, emet ve'emunah, true and faith is all this. Also, the fundament of faith is to believe in the truth, and therefore the sages said, words of truth can be recognized. Nikarim divrei emet. Fabulous principle in the Talmud. It's Delilah, the negative, the villain in the Samson story. Delilah is the person who could recognize the truth when Samson told her that the way to destroy his strength is by cutting his hair. And she realized it was true. And the Talmud says, how did she realize? And a very interesting statement is, when it's true, you can recognize it. So even Delilah, she could recognize the truth. And so therefore, and for that, you don't need any proof. You just recognize the truth. So he's stepping off the whole rationalist bandwagon, and he's saying, no, you just have to have pure faith. So if that's the case, exactly what is the function of this book? Now, an interesting thing about the book, which does not appear in this first edition printed in 1957, is that the late Lubavitcher Rebbe wrote a commentary on it. The late Lubavitcher Rebbe went through the entire book and wrote a commentary to it, a brief commentary, but footnotes, and that is printed in the second edition. In the later edition. The later edition is also in square letters instead of these Rashi letters, which is all a fascinating thing. Now, why did the Tzemach Tzedek write this book? In 1843, there was a special commission in Petersburg. I'll finish in just a moment. In 1843, there was a commission in Petersburg in order to the minister of culture called Uvarov wanted to develop a new secularized school system for the Jewish community. For this, he convened a commission which included the Tzemach Tzedek, Rabbi Yitzchak of Volozhin, the head of the sort of Lithuanian school of Talmudists, and a number of maskilim, including a maskil who came, Lilienthal, who came from Germany, and a Russian maskil as well, or a few. And what the late Lubavitcher Rebbe suggests is that the book was written somehow to do, or I think the previous Rebbe actually says this, that this book was written in relation to those discussions. Now, there was a particular figure who was a very difficult person in these discussions, and may well have subscribed to the idea that the world is eternal, the Aristotelian view. And for the Tzemach Tzedek, the discussions went on for months, and it's quite possible that he wrote part of this work during the discussions. He was there in Petersburg, and at a certain point he might well have had time. There was discussions, and then there were pauses. The discussions were kept secret, and to this day no record of them has directly come out. There have been a few letters from different people, and historians have put together different concepts. Iri Luria wrote a very interesting book about, or section of one of his books about this. But I think that we could understand the Tzemach Tzedek getting into the whole philosophic tradition in order to deal with these figures whom he was working with in order to in order for his attempt to protect the education system of the Jewish community. In fact, what happened was that there was a secularized education system which produced, set in motion by the Tsar, it produced all the Jewish intellectuals who then flowed into the Russian Revolution. So it's all right. But at the same time, there was protection for the traditional Cheder system as well. So that is one aspect of it. But another aspect of it is that the Tzemach Tzedek, as told, as related by the 6th Lubavitcher Rebbe, the Tzemach Tzedek had an unusual interest in philosophy, quite apart from this. And in fact, he initiated around the end of 1852 a daily study session with his 18-year-old son, Reb Shmuel, who later on became the next Lubavitcher Rebbe. And for 2 years they studied Kabbalah, and then for 18 months the subject was philosophy, Saadia Gaon, Guide for the Perplexed, Ikarim, Kuzari, exploring it in terms of Chabad teachings. Now that's the interesting thing, because He wrote halachic works. He wrote this slim volume on philosophy and several dozen books of Chabad mystical teachings. And to the Tzemach Tzedek, I believe that this continuum of Jewish thought is really the way in which he looked at the world, and that is what he was ultimately trying to express, even though he believed that the most powerful way of understanding things is through the power of faith. He also believed that there was a point in having these Jewish philosophical books on your bookshelf, and that they too express the oneness of God. Yes.
I'm quite interested. At the beginning, you said that the Tanakh said it burned his congregation from reading the Guide to Perplexed.
No, that was Rabbi Nachman of Breslov.
Yes, sorry, that's yeah. Right. But how far would that ban have extended? Would it have included Sadio back here as well?
Oh, yes. For Rabbi Nachman of Breslov. Whether it included Bachya, I'm not sure, but he includes Ralbag, Gersonides, he has a whole list of works that he frowned on. He wanted a complete innocent approach to life. It's a very intriguing area in Breslov's studies. Arthur Green has written about this in his book on Rabbi Nachman, Tormented Master. So there is an appendix on the issue of Rabbi Nachman's fascination with and rejection of philosophy. Yes?
At the end of it, you said, if I've got this right, how do you strengthen faith by believing in the truth? How do you recognise the truth simply by knowing? Is that summary of what? Was that Maimonides?
No, that is the Tzemach Tzedek himself writing that at the end of this book.
Right.
The after going through all these philosophical proofs for the existence of God and the creation of the world, he then says, "But the path is not philosophy. The path is simple faith. And the way you strengthen faith is by studying Torah." And then you recognize, you come to a higher level of sight.
So the reward for faith is faith.
Yes, I think the reward for faith is seeing.
Yeah, right.
As the English phrase, seeing is believing.
Yeah.
And in fact, Kabbalistically or in Hasidic terms, ri'iya, sight, is wisdom. Ri'iya de chokhmah, the sight of wisdom. By seeing that you are able to appreciate the reality.
Right. Thank you very much.
Yes?
Thank you very much for the presentation. Do any of the people who cite the faith versus philosophy argument, do they grapple with the fact that people from all different religions and persuasions and ideologies and political associations as well seem to make the same argument, and they seem to be equally convinced, and therefore it's ultimately unconfirmable, or you can't corroborate, because it seems to be a subjective perception that once we learn enough about something, we seem to be convinced of that worldview. And also, if that were simply true, you really wouldn't need philosophy at all. You would just, we don't need philosophy to tell us there's a window out there and we shouldn't jump out of it, right? If it's that substantial. So really, the two questions, number one, it's an argument with people from all over. It actually strikes me as a particularly Christian argument, actually, to precisely this, that, you know, to prove one's by faith. And the second thing, if it were really sufficient, then why would you need philosophy?
Well, I mean, David Hume said, you know, since all religions claim to be right, exclusively makes it much more likely that they're all not right. So, now that's, you see, there are different levels of faith, and the central concept of faith that the Meiri, actually, the Meiri was a great sage, lived in Provence in, I think, the 14th or 15th century. His writings only fairly recently came to light and were published, so they were not known, for example, by the Tzemach Tzedek. He makes the point that all members, this is on his commentary to Bava Kamma 113b, he wrote a commentary in the whole Talmud. And on that page, he says, any human being who believes in some kind of God, even if other aspects of their faith might put them greatly at variance with Judaism, but they have that central faith in God, puts them in a totally different class to the idolater who is the subject of many Talmudic discussions and is to be treated as a Jew in all other respects. And so he there transcends the differences between different religions, saying that the main thing is faith in God. And in fact, when we look at the Kalam, the Islamic tradition of philosophy, Christian mystics for that matter, and thinkers, they are all, when they are speaking about God, in a sense, there's a lot of sharing of material. St. Augustine used Maimonides' Guide for the Perplexed, and Maimonides used Arabic philosophers, so Al-Farabi, and so there is a kind of continuum, which Dr. Salmon here is an expert on. So in terms of God, that is a point where everyone can really unite. When you get down to particular issues within any particular religion, then that becomes the difference. But vive la différence.
Nice. Two small questions. Number one, has anyone actually sat down and went through the Tzemach Tzedek citations of earlier sources, of philosophical sources, to see if he's quoting them directly from the original source, or if he's quoting them as they're extracted, they're mentioned in media and works that stand chronologically and even theologically, ideologically in between those sources? For example, if he's quoting, is he quoting Maimonides' Guide of the Perplexed directly, or is he quoting Guide of the Perplexed as quoted in who stands in between the two of them at some point?
My feeling is he's definitely quoting the Guide and Albo, and I mean those books were available to him, and Sadia.
Yeah.
I didn't do any kind of careful, like, philological check, but there's every feeling that he is looking directly at these books. He was known to have a large collection of books, and when we look at the printing dates, all those books were available. I mean, this was the heyday of Jewish printing. At an earlier, I think those books were available. I think even by Russian law, those books could be printed. I'm not sure about this. It's anything new that couldn't be printed. That's why Hasidic teachings couldn't be printed.
Interestingly enough, in his book called Derech Mitzvos Nisim Sefa, which we're not speaking about today, he has a section, as you're well aware, called the Belief or Faith in Divinity.
Yes.
And in that section, he quotes the same concept that he mentioned earlier, which is a necessary being. But there, he quotes it in a more nuanced way, and he uses the wording that's actually used by Avicenna, which is that which is necessary in and of itself. He gives this new layer. And in Avicenna, there are things that are necessary not in and of themselves, but necessary as necessary byproducts of the of some other cause. So, example, you have God, the ultimate thing that's necessary in and of itself, and then you have things that emerge from God by necessity in Avicenna's mind, and those things are necessary but not in and of themselves, and then you have contingencies, things that change, things that can or can't, that flexible, they can either be or they cannot be. And he, as I was wondering where, how, why he brings in that other place in the reference of Tefla, why he brings this idea of necessary in and of itself, why he goes to that level.
And that phrasing isn't there in the Ibn Tibbon translation of the guide?
And that's I don't know. That's that I don't know.
Which I think would be the place to look, exactly. I mean, that was the only translation of the guide. Or he might have had the Al-Kharizi translation.
Okay.
But they would, that would be where to look, I would have thought.
But he didn't use that further, the extended phrase in the Sefer HaBakira,
He might have done. What exactly is the phrase in Hebrew?
Mechuyev ha-metziyut mitzad atzmo.
Mitzad atzmo.
I believe something like that.
It could be. I'm not sure.
Why you didn't, because it sort of goes against the idea to say that there are things that are necessary not in and of themselves, but because of their source, that it goes against the idea that creation is not the mechanical necessity, but it's an act of will.
Mm.
So I'm just wondering why that's...
Intriguing.
Thank you very much. Thank you.